This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. It's time for This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. Joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And this week, one country is in the spotlight. Yes, the world of finance is getting rather twitchy about Deutsche Bank. Its shares diving this week with reports some big customers are beginning to withdraw their cash. What on earth is going on? Why should we care about a German bank?
If markets continue to get spooked by the situation, then that is going to feed through potentially to the wider economy.
And it's not all bad news for our German friends, as discount supermarket Aldi continues to turn the screw on the big boys. Big expansion plans are in the offing. Is it all good news for them, though?
No, it's all very well annoying Tesco and Sainsbury's and Morrison's, but it's going to hurt Aldi as well.
So can Britain emerge as the leading economic light?
We stand on the verge of an unprecedented ability to liberate global trade for the benefit of our whole planet.
Jumping up the global economic competitiveness table. But is it all rosy as it seems for the UK? Also today, we run the rule over a new government crackdown on cyber criminals. Simon plays the long game when it comes to mortgages. And BHS is back. Sort of. We'll be taking a look at the reinvented BHS.com. Does it have legs?
That is great news in the sense that a very large number of people lost their jobs and have been treated pretty shabbily. And these people have come along and it's a vote of confidence.
And to celebrate 50 years of Money Mail, we'll also have the 50 top ways to save you money. Well, we'll have some of them at least. The rest are on This Is Money's website. Do go and take a look. But I want to know today some of the more quirky or unusual money-saving tips that you have or that you've heard of. A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Lee. Simon, to you first, some quirky or unusual money-saving tips that you have for us.
Hide money from yourself.
OK, that's a good one.
So I think I might have raised this once before on the show, that the best savings account I ever had was with Tesco Bank. I opened it and I set up £100 a month direct debit into this bank account. And Tesco Bank had this sort of strange three-stage password security to get into it. In order to reset the passwords, I think it had to involve something being posted to you for one of them. So basically I set this up and then I couldn't get into it for 2 years.
OK.
Basically, not because it was that difficult, mm-hmm. but because every time I tried to do it, I had to reset a password or something, and then the emails didn't arrive immediately, or you had to wait for this thing to be posted to you, so inertia kicked in, and I didn't do it. Then the next time I tried to do it, so I'd set up this standing order that I couldn't cancel for £100 a month, and I couldn't get into the bank account. By the time I got into the bank account, I had saved £2,400.
That is not bad from a mixture of inertia and ineptitude. Lee, for you?
I don't do this much anymore. But follow the sticker man around the supermarket. I used to love doing that. I do still occasionally do it, and then stick whatever I can find and put it in the freezer. Maybe that's not that unusual these days. There seems to be more people. They flock around him like seagulls. But back in the day, about 5 or 6 years ago, people didn't do it as much. And when I was a student, it was brilliant. I used to get some right bargains. I used to come back to the hall and think, this is great.
I have images life. Of you just following the guy around or the woman around.
Can you
round.
Write that down another 10p? Come
oh,
on,
God,
mate.
It's that man again. It's that man. Quick, what do you want? For me, it is something I've got very good at as I've got older. It's complaining about things. In a nice way, I'd like to point out, though. I've saved a lot of money just by going, OK, well, that's not great service. I assume you're going to compensate me. And nice. Then it's on them. Yeah.
So it's almost like reverse psychology, it sounds like that.
Well, I would say the other thing that probably saves me quite a lot of money is I really, really dislike shops.
OK, yeah, that would
I really
work.
Dislike shopping, basically. I'll do anything to avoid shopping. And as a man, my shopping tactic is walk into shop, buy what I need and leave stat. So I don't go into them. So I spend less money. It's that simple. Also, I'm not really into that whole thing that appears to be my wife's hobby, which is mm-hmm. buying clothes on the internet so she can send them back. I think that's a really popular hobby amongst many people nowadays. They buy things on the internet so they can send them back. I'm not into that either, so I just don't buy that much stuff.
I'd say not buying stuff is a great money-saving tip. Thank you very much. That voice you're hearing, editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from This Is Money, are back in the studio with us in partnership with NS&I to go through some of the stories that they've been looking at this week. Coming up, more good news about the British economy. Is Project Fear officially dead? Well, not quite. But first, the greatest threat to economic stability in the future of the euro since the 2008 crash. Goodness me, that's the view of the Daily Mail city editor Alex Brummer about the troubles at Germany's largest lender, Deutsche Bank. The value of shares crashed this week, falling to a new record low below €10 at one stage. Investors rattled by a report that some hedge funds have been withdrawing funds from the bank. Now, with parallels drawn to the financial crisis of 2008... have we got another Lehman Brothers on our hands? Philip Alexander is regulation editor at Risk.net. Doesn't think the comparisons are entirely accurate.
In 2008, the concern wasn't just around Lehman Brothers. It was around the entire financial sector, in particular all the large investment banks. People were concerned how much they were holding in terms of subprime securities and how bad the losses were. In this instance, it's very much focused on Deutsche Bank itself, partly there's that fine in the United States, and partly simply that Deutsche has been more leveraged than other banks. In other words, for the size of its balance sheet, it's got less capital. So I think this is quite specific to Deutsche Bank. The second difference is really the reforms that have taken place since 2008. The fact that other banks are holding more capital makes them more resilient to a shock. But also what's happened in the derivatives market, that was the big transmission mechanism, not only with Lehman Brothers, but also with AIG, that when they got into trouble, a lot of other banks were exposed to them through the derivatives markets. Now, what regulators have done since 2008 is instead of having banks trade directly with each other, they're trading through clearing houses. So that means that channel of contagion that we saw in 2008 through the derivatives markets is much less of a risk today. The concern is more that regulators are likely to ask Deutsche to raise extra capital. And the effect of that is obviously it'll dilute the existing Deutsche Bank shareholders. And also where the bank has issued subordinated bonds, they may have to cancel the coupon payments on those bonds. So basically, investors in Deutsche are going to suffer a loss. You know, the bank itself is unlikely to go down.
Here's John Hardy, head of FX strategy at Saxo Bank, telling Share Radio what we know and don't know about what's going on inside Deutsche right now.
It is a large systemic bank, and there's a political message from German leadership, political leadership, that it's not going to bail Deutsche Bank out. So if, for whatever reason, there is a severe problem, it doesn't necessarily mean that we see a Lehman-style unwind, but of course we're not going to expect a bailout like was seen in the global financial crisis early days in the U.S. So certainly there'll be disruptions if Deutsche Bank, something of the size of Deutsche Bank, is in serious trouble, without speculating on whether that's going to happen.
So whispers that the German government might bail them out. But then we got even more bad news concerning the country's banking sector after Commerzbank, the second biggest, announced 10,000 global job cuts. It's also going to stop dividend payouts to investors for the first time ever. So, Simon, what on earth is going on in Germany? Firstly, at Deutsche, British chief exec John Cryan emailing staff at the back end of this week saying the bank has become the object of hefty speculation and that new rumours are causing the share price to fall. But the bank's finances are strong. At no point in the last 20 years has Deutsche Bank been as strong as it is now, he says. So what's going on?
Well, I mean, just think about what that 20 years has been for our banks. What a fine period. What a fine period to compare it to. I mean, how many years are we since the financial crisis now? 8, 9? yeah. So the thing with Deutsche Bank is that basically it's not really been doing very well for quite some time now. And in fact, John Cryan was brought in to try and fix the bank in the first place. So the bank wasn't doing very well. It's then been hit with this massive fine from America's Department of Justice, which has asked for $14 billion. Now, to put that into context, basically, the fine is about £10.8 billion. Mm-hmm. That's the size of that fine. At the moment, Deutsche Bank itself is worth about £13 billion. So the fine is pretty much all of what Deutsche Bank is worth. However, Deutsche points to the fact that it basically has this huge pile of, you know, sort of liquid assets that are much, much bigger than the fine. And also that it basically doesn't actually expect to pay that fine in full. Mm. The way these fines work are, it's a bit of a, there's a lot of horse trading that goes on. But people had been expecting the fine to be about $3 billion, so obviously $14 billion is quite a lot larger. But the other problem is that basically in 2015, Deutsche Bank lost 6.8 billion euros.
Well, like, whoops, we lost it? Or?
Yeah, well, they're no more in the sort of banking right. profit and loss sense of losing money, okay. where it's very difficult to ascertain whether money that is made in profit in 1 year or made in a loss in 1 year has any actual relation to real money as you or I know it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of accounting going on. There's a lot of losses booked. Then there's a lot of profits booked that, you know, I mean, a great book to read about this is John Kay's Other People's Money, where he kind of takes a massive pot shot at the banking industry and says that we need banks. You know, we need banks to extend credit. We need banks to hold our money. We need banks to help us grow our wealth. We need them as individuals and we need them as businesses. But probably if you look at the global banking sector, about 25% of what it does is related to that. And the other 75% mainly just involves trading with itself. And the trading with itself thing, in some years, delivers huge profits, and in some years, it delivers huge losses. And it's very difficult to see whether this actually adds any value whatsoever to the economy, shareholders, or us as individuals. And I think that the Deutsche Bank scenario pretty much illustrates that quite well.
OK, so didn't Deutsche reasonably weather the financial crash? Lots of regulations came in. Is it an issue of perhaps others learnt the lesson? They didn't, and they are an island of their own. So this is not going to spread. What is your take on that?
Well, so I think it's still very, very difficult to ascertain with these, you know, mega banks like the Deutsches of this world, you know, like our very own RBS, exactly what kind of exposure they have to exactly what. I mean, we've got a story today running, written by James Burton on the City Desk of the Daily Mail, that says it reportedly has a $35 trillion portfolio of complex high-risk derivatives on its books.
Right, so lessons really learned there. And
these are that's more than half the size of the global economy. Now, that's not suggesting that Deutsche Bank has half of the size of the global economy that's going to go kaput. But the problem is that when people say complex high-risk derivatives, it's basically shorthand for stuff that even when the person from the bank explains to you what they do and what these things are, you're left looking at them with a blank expression on your face and the shutters over your eyes. I have a friend who works in the sort of complex high-risk derivative end of banking. I literally do not understand what he does.
Lee, you're laughing along there. It's nerves, isn't it?
It's nerves. I read that sentence this morning about the $35 trillion, and it did kind of spook me a little bit. And also, last weekend, I was a little bit unwell, and I decided to watch The Big Short. I hadn't seen it yet, right. It's on Netflix now. It really does describe, you know, what happened in 2008.
It's going to cheer you up,
isn't
it? I've
had that in my head all week, and I don't. This Deutsche thing sort of come about, and now all of a sudden I'm just sort of got myself a bit frightened. I think I've got myself a little bit scared by it all. And the thing is, the scale of this is actually quite hard to ascertain what is actually going on, because it's quite a closed book. We don't quite know. You know, we're saying £35 trillion of complex derivatives. Where? What's going on? What is the actual exposure? How much is toxic of this? And as you say, is it going to spread to other banks? Right. Are other banks sort of still in the same boat? Have they been taking on the regulation that the EU set out in the aftermath of the financial crisis to try and make sure there wasn't another financial crisis? And then let's not forget, some countries in Europe are still not past the pre-crisis recession. We're talking Italy, Greece. You know, they're still struggling. What are the state of their banks?
Well, that's it. One time, have we got another Lehman Brothers on our hands? That's the comparison being drawn. And yes, how does this relate to other places like Italy and the like?
Well, the thing with Lehman Brothers is, the problem with Lehman Brothers is Lehman Brothers was allowed to go bust, and the decision was made that Lehman Brothers was not so important to the financial system that it needed to be bailed out. And this was, bear in mind, before a lot of the bank bailout stuff happened. It was still when there was this question of, do you bail them out, do you not bail them out? And so it was allowed to go bust, and then everybody wasn't quite sure how they were exposed, and everything just shuttered down. If Deutsche Bank was allowed to go bust, then yes, it would, the effects would be catastrophic. But Deutsche Bank isn't going to be allowed to go bust. They're just, you know, however the situation is resolved, maybe it doesn't need a bailout. It says it doesn't need a bailout, and the German government says it doesn't need a bailout. However the situation is resolved, Deutsche Bank will not be allowed to go bust.
It's going to be politically dodgy, though, for the German government to do that.
There's two things going on here. Firstly, The German government has made the mistake of saying there were, you know, kind of there won't be a bailout. We won't bail out the bank. Now, the way that the bailout game works is that you don't necessarily have to actually bail out a bank, and you don't have to say that you will bail out a bank. Mm-hmm. You just have to not say that you won't bail out a bank. So it has to be implicit. So if you think about since the financial crisis, basically, all of those banks have benefited from the fact that it's kind of been implicit. Everybody thinks that they won't be allowed to go bust and the right. government will stand behind them. And governments around the world have taken on huge debts. As I say governments, us, we, me, you, Lee, all sat around here, taken on our share of huge debts to bail out banks. Now, the ECB, they've brought in this bank bail-in thing now, which is to try and solve this problem of bailouts and say, well, we're not going to bail out banks anymore. We're going to bail in people. So the people, you know, the creditors, the people who hold money with the bank above that, the level that is protected, you know, they're all going to have to pay. Now, Italy, it has its own problems with quite a lot of its banks, and it wants to bail them out because it wants to try and solve this problem where its economy is not growing and banks aren't lending, and it wants to bail them out, and it doesn't want ordinary people to take a hit. And the reason why lots of ordinary people in Italy will take a hit is because, basically, a lot of them have basically bought bank bonds. Italy, they like to buy bonds. In the same way that we like to buy shares or property, maybe, in this country. I mean, they like to buy property in Italy as well. But they like to buy bonds. And a lot of them have been sold these bank bonds that there's this kind of suspicion that they thought they were like a savings account. Or maybe they knew they were buying bonds. But if a lot of these banks were to bail in, then those people who bought those bonds would lose large amounts of money. And those are ordinary savers and ordinary investors. And the Italian government doesn't want this to happen, and it wants to bail out the banks. But it was told by the German, by the ECB, and by the German government, and Angela Merkel said you can't just change the rules every 2 years, earlier this summer, that it wasn't allowed to bail out its banks. And there was this suggestion that the Italian government might just even defy the ECB altogether and the German government and just bail out the banks and say, well, look, we're doing it. But so this is very politically charged at the moment. And now you've got the situation where the country that's seen as leading the thinking of the ECB and telling everyone else you can't bail out the banks now has this big bank that might need bailing out.
Isn't there a German word for that that springs to Schadenfreude or something sort of springs to mind?
Yeah, I think so. And so what's happening with all of this is understandably people around the world who hold Deutsche Bank shares are selling them.
Right.
They're deciding we don't want to hold Deutsche Bank shares anymore. And Deutsche Bank's share price has absolutely crashed over the last year. And the lower that share price falls, the less Deutsche Bank is theoretically worth. And then you get to this scenario where basically theoretically it owes a fine that is nearly worth as much as the bank.
Isn't the idea, though, and as Lee rightly pointed out, watching The Big Short, I've seen it too, I know how this sort of stuff works. Hedge funds withdrawing funds from their bank may tell another story. They may be shorting. They may profit from a fallen share, no?
Yes.
So how real is that?
Well, this is the situation with the financial system is money, you know, runs around the place. There's a lot of cheap money at the moment and it washes in here and then it washes out of there. You could see a scenario where everybody's dumping Deutsche Bank shares. Deutsche Bank shares are heavily shorted. The share price keeps falling. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, on the basis that we suspect that nobody's ever going to actually allow Deutsche to go bust, a load of hedge funds just pile in and start buying up the shares, and all of a sudden the share price doubles or trebles in a very short space of time. Now, the issue at the moment is basically with this fine is that because people are suggesting that Deutsche doesn't have the money to pay this fine, it might have to raise new money by basically issuing new shares to investors to try and get them to buy new shares in the bank. But basically, what person is going to want to buy shares in a bank knowing that that money will not go into investing in the bank and improving the bank's fortune, but you're basically handing money to the bank who's then going to hand it to the US government?
Are British banks safe?
All banks are safer than they were, as in that they hold a much greater cushion against going bust and against losses. Whether the banking system is as safe as everybody suggests it is another question. I think if you look at, you have to look at what a bank does. So a bank like Lloyds, for example, which includes the old HBOS, which has got rid of a lot of the old bad loans that they made. There's a lot of bad loans on commercial and property and stuff like that. That's probably quite a lot safer now than it was at one point. A bank like RBS or Barclays, which is much more exposed to that sort of global banking, world of fancy finance, derivatives and investment banking, you know, they're theoretically safer in terms of the amount of money they hold, but it's still very difficult to ascertain what their exposure is to stuff.
Lee, final one to you quickly. Have we learnt anything from the crash, do you reckon?
Doesn't sound like it, does it? But I don't know. As Simon says there, it's not all doom and gloom. You know, banks do have bigger cushions now. You know, rules did come in. I'm thinking about things like there was real sort of dodgy lending in the run-up to the financial crisis. OK, a lot of that was in the US, but there was a lot of it going on here as well. We think about interest-only mortgages, for example. Things like that have been cracked. You know, there's been a crackdown on that sort of thing. You know, I think we're in a better position. Let's hope so.
Well, let's hope so indeed. And if not, we can cheer ourselves up with some good news. More good news about the UK economy, no less. We've leapfrogged Japan, Hong Kong and Finland to become the seventh most competitive economy in the world. That's according to the World Economic Forum's Global Competitive Report. Here is Share Radio senior analyst Ed Bauscher.
So the World Economic Forum is a body that helps dialogue between politicians, people in the private sector, economists and so forth. They run the annual meeting at Davos, and the idea is you get these people cooperating, then that will help the global economy to grow more quickly. They do these annual competitiveness survey every year, and it looks at a variety of factors to see how strong a country's economy is. How likely is it to compete successfully against other economies? In this year's survey, the UK's moved up from 10th to 7th. The forum looks at things like the quality of infrastructure, so that's road and railways, also at health and education, because that helps businesses as well as individuals. It's encouraging that the UK's moved up three places in this year's survey.
Amazing. Great news. I think Ed was about to say but then, because it's not quite. Firstly, the report was based on data taken before the Brexit vote, and it reckons our new ranking is under threat because of our decision to leave. And then came the Bank of England to further dampen the mood. Manu Shafiq, the Deputy Governor for Markets and Banking, said in a speech that uncertainty surrounding Brexit negotiations is weighing on investment. She reckons more monetary stimulus might be needed as the UK faces up to a sizeable economic shock. Nonetheless, Foreign Trade Secretary Liam Fox, optimistic.
We stand on the verge of an unprecedented ability to liberate global trade for the benefit of our whole planet. Yet, this bright future is being darkened by the shadows of protectionism and retrenchment, and history teaches us that such trends do not bode well. And the UK has a golden opportunity to forge a new role for ourselves in the world, one which puts the British people first. I believe that the UK is in a prime position to become a world leader in free trade because of the brave and historic decision of the British people to leave the European Union. Those who believe that the referendum was a sign of Britain looking inwards have it completely 100% wrong. It is the beginning of Britain increasing its global engagement. We are leaving the EU, we are not leaving Europe, and we're ready to take our place in an open, liberal and competitive globalised trading environment.
Righto, fab stuff. Simon, global competitiveness, what does this all mean?
It means that you are a competitive place to do economic stuff and
we are
business
even more
kind
so.
Of things. Yeah, so basically it's measured on a number of things. Institutions, infrastructure, health and education, market size and the macroeconomic environment. And Switzerland is the top dog. So a jump in tech savviness, making it the most technologically prepared country, meant Switzerland achieved the highest competitiveness score since WEF introduced a new ranking system in 2007. And the report said, Switzerland arguably possesses one of the world's most fertile innovation ecosystems, combining a very conducive policy environment and infrastructure, academic excellence, an unmatched capacity to attract the best talent and large multinationals that are often leaders in their sector, as well as a dense network of small and medium-sized enterprises.
I want to put some music on it, put it on YouTube and use it as part of Switzerland's economic tourism board.
So if you ever doubted that Switzerland was a great place to live, thanks to its low taxes, beautiful mountain scenery, fine weather, and the fact that people speak a multitude of languages and just swan around being super sophisticated.
Very expensive, though, isn't it?
Then don't doubt it now. Yeah, but you get paid more money. So my sister worked in Switzerland for 3 or 4 years. She used to work winter seasons in a ski resort. And when she first went over, bear in mind she's 11 years younger than me, when she first went over there, she was working in a bar and a hotel and she was earning more money than I was.
Nice.
Yeah, so there you go.
Oh, yeah, but Britain, though, or UK economy moving up the table, is it a bit like a Premier League team that just found out that their star player is injured? And actually, when we find out what's going to happen with the Brexit, bear with me on this one, the Brexit negotiations, it could actually mean that we fall back down the list. So actually, all of this is pointless, really.
We've been swigging port from the Lucozade bottle before we go on the pitch. yeah, I mean, obviously this survey was done before the Brexit vote. And now you could argue that removing us from the world's largest and most important free trade area might dent our competitiveness slightly, unless you're Liam Fox, who has decided that it actually improves it greatly.
Well, he's very positive. But what about the negativity we're hearing as well? Manoush Shafiq, I was saying there, suggesting that more perhaps fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus would be needed. But we were also hearing the UK economy grew 0.7% in the second quarter, according to the ONS, revised up from its previous estimate of 0.6%. So do we need help? Do we not?
I couldn't think of anything that the UK economy could do with more than more low interest rates, more quantitative easing and more funny money. Because I think that it's done absolute wonders for how we've been doing over the past 7 or 8 years.
Agree with that, Lee?
Perfect. Yeah. Couldn't say it better than that.
It's all just guesswork then, right?
No, it is. It's just mixed messages, isn't it? I mean, you got one person on one hand saying we need more, do we need this? It's almost like they don't know what's happened in the aftermath of Brexit. Well, we haven't left the EU yet, but in the aftermath of the vote. So this is a theme that's going everywhere, George, isn't it? We don't
so
quite
true.
Know what's going on because it's still just a couple of months.
Yeah, so. It gives us something to talk about though, doesn't it? So next week, same thing. Yep, yeah. Nice and easy. Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, Editor Simon Lambert.
This is Money. Brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NSNI. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. And bye-bye. Help to buy. The mortgage guarantee scheme's being dropped by the government. Chancellor Philip Hammond claims it successfully achieved its purpose to help young people buy homes. But not everyone is so convinced about its success. Here's Share Radio's Ed Boucher again.
I'm not really a fan. I mean, OK, I understand why people liked it. Very hard for young people to get on the property ladder. So this scheme helped them find money for a deposit so they can get a mortgage and get on the property ladder. But the thing that about this scheme that I didn't like was that I think in the end it was doing more harm than good because it meant more people were buying more quickly and just pushing up house prices. So I think Philip Hammond, by scrapping this, has made the right move. I'm told it was really David Cameron's policy, not so much George Osborne's. He was particularly keen on it. But either way, I think it probably is the right way to go. But the crucial point here is the best thing we can do for people in their 20s, early 30s, mid-30s, is to get house prices down. Easier said than done. But
By building more.
Exactly.
It'll close to new loans at the end of the year after being used 185,000 times. Firstly, Lee, what's the difference between the Help to Buy scheme and the Help to Buy ISA?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you what the difference is between the Help to Buy guarantee scheme and the Help to Buy equity loan scheme.
Right,
so this
great.
Guarantee scheme, basically, you find a 5% deposit on a house. It doesn't have to be a new build. It can be any type of property. The government would put in up to 20% of that to put towards the house. The lender would then give you the rest of the mortgage. Now, the reason the government did that in the first place was because, A, first-time buyers were struggling to get on the market because lenders were seeing it as risky. You know, if there was a house price crash, this government bit of loan would be the first one to soak up some of that pressure. So that's the part of the scheme that's been dropped. Now, the ISA is completely different.
Well, they should have had another name, shouldn't they?
Yeah. Well, but they're Help to Buy ISA.
Confusing.
It is confusing. And we talk about this week in, week out, just how many confusing things there are. It's just like, oh my God, make it one thing. You save monthly into this ISA. The government will give you a bonus and then you can use it to put towards a house. As we discovered last month, actually, that's not technically true because you have to wait for the house to complete, which can cause some problems, you know, to get that government bonus element. That's being replaced by the lifetime ISA next year. You see where I'm going with this. Yeah, it's just like, no wonder they're scrapping something, because otherwise they're going to bring something else out and we're just going to have a rainbow of products to buy a house. So this part of the scheme, so there's the equity loan scheme that I mentioned just then, which is for new build properties. That's not going. That's mm-hmm. going to be there till 2020. This guarantee scheme element actually helped 86,000 people onto the ladder in the last 3 years, which... it's not bad. It's not exactly brilliant. But the argument is, and as Ed rightly said there, and a lot of experts have said this, and there's an expert at the Adam Smith Institute who I thought summed it up pretty well. He said, he's not a fan of this, by the way, the Adam Smith mm-hmm. Institute, this help to buy scheme element. He said, Britain's housing crisis is the result of supply being unable to meet rising demand. Help to buy only served to make this problem worse, pushing up prices through cheap credit while doing nothing to address the underlying housing shortage. And that we're coming back to that
Fair
again.
Enough, though,
we're
it?
Not building enough houses. Yeah. All that scheme has probably done is whacked a little bit more onto house prices. Probably Mr. Cameron and Mr. Osborne probably wanted that a little bit because, you know, the link between house prices going up, economy looking strong is quite closely linked.
So was that the reason then Chancellor Hammond decided to cancel it? Was there something else in that?
Well, he actually written a letter to Mark Carney saying that this part of the Help to Buy scheme, the guarantee scheme, had run its course. It basically served its purpose. It got, you know, I'm guessing they had targets of how many people we're going to get onto the property ladder using it, but they're probably thinking house prices are actually going up and up and up, and this is probably causing pressure, you know, using this scheme. Plus, people have got the Help to Buy ISA, and they've still got the equity loan scheme on new builds. You know, they're not going to scrap, as Simon said to me yesterday, they're not probably going to scrap the new build one. Well, they can't because it's still 2020, but they wouldn't scrap that one because otherwise you just have a load of new builds just sitting around that people probably wouldn't buy, because a lot of new builds are being bought with the Help to Buy equity scheme.
Simon, your views?
Well, I think what's interesting here is that this, you know, the Help to Buy mortgage guarantee scheme, as Lee said, basically it enabled lenders to issue more low deposit mortgages, so 95% mortgages mainly, and the government underwrites, you know, 15% of the loan. So if something goes bad, you default on it, your 5% deposit as the buyer takes the first hit, the government will take the next 15% hit, and the lender's only on the hook for the rest of the money. But what happened before this was introduced, and the reason why I had a problem with Help to Buy, beyond the fact that giving people more cheap money is surely only going to continue driving up the price of the expensive asset, is that the market for 10% and 5% deposit mortgages had already opened up quite a lot. In the months, probably the 6 months running up to the advent of this, in autumn 2013, things had already freed up. I think it was unnecessary. I don't think that this needed to come in. I think it was a little bit of a flagship, headline-grabbing, we're helping first-time buyers policy that probably has caused as much harm as good. I think then, you know, it was due to end anyway, but it's not been extended. It's going to stop. And this is, the housing market has had any number of crutches put underneath it over the past 5 years, and that has helped sustain house prices continuing to rise by much more in some parts of the country than in others. But wherever you look, if you compare the average wage in that part of the country to house prices, they're high, basically. And it's been kept afloat by all these crutches put under the housing market. But what you're seeing, I think, is some of these crutches starting to be kicked out. So, yeah, interest rates probably aren't going anywhere anytime soon, and mortgage rates are super low, but this bit of Help to Buy is being kicked out. The equity loan thing is very difficult to kick out because a lot of new build purchases are reliant upon it, and it would probably seriously dent the amount of houses we're building. But I think what we're going to see is a change of direction, and all of those artificial, you know, props that are being put under the housing market are going to start being removed.
And do you think that would help in terms of house prices?
Well, ideally, we don't really want house prices to keep rising.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on what survey you look at, the average house price is going up between anything between like about 7 and 10% annually. And wages are going up by about 2%. And because of the way that big numbers work, your house is probably going to be a larger number than your salary. And so as your house goes up by 10%, your wage only goes up by 2%. The gap between the two things gets increasingly sizable. So I think it's very difficult to say we want house prices to fall. Unfortunately, the only way for houses to be cheaper is for house prices to fall. But it's very difficult to say that because that's going to hurt a lot of people and really dent their confidence. But what we certainly don't want is house prices to keep going up at a steady clip.
But what about a swathe of young people, Lee, who need some help, I imagine, if they want to get on the housing ladder?
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, this is what all these schemes have been brought out for, to help these young people get onto the property ladder. What the trouble is with it, I mean, a 5% deposit, it just means you can get on the property ladder faster than you would have done if you were trying to save for a 10% deposit, say, or a 15% deposit. You know, if you're looking to buy a house, I just think, you know, and you're starting from scratch, the Help to Buy is not a bad place to start. Or you could just wait it out. You know, Simon's saying that the housing market's built on stilts. Perhaps just wait for the stilts to fall. Maybe the prices will start coming down. But yeah, there's obviously no guarantee of that. I would just say regularly save if you can. Mm. Build up a target amount that you think is going to be a deposit and go from there.
Do you know the only person I've ever known to use a Help to Buy ISA personally?
No.
Was a Deutsche Banker. I kid you not. Simon, you've been typing away, sticking with property. You've been blogging. It's all about playing the long game and our short-termist view. This is not about investing, though, this time. Tackling the issue of how long you should fix a mortgage for. Now, we've been hearing that question a lot. So, Simon, 2 minutes. Yes, time starts now.
We love two-year fixed-rate mortgages in this country. Absolutely love them. And I think that our love for them is a little bit misguided. And I mean, we talk about subprime mortgages and the property market problems in the States and these things called teaser rates, where you got a low rate for a short period of time and then it suddenly jumped. Does that sound like anything? Sounds like a two-year fixed rate mortgage to me. But I think that my issue with this is not necessarily that two-year fixed rate mortgages are inherently bad in any way, but just I think a lot of people would probably be better off fixing for longer. And I think that if you look at the split, it's probably about 60%, 50 to 60% people take two-year fixes at the moment. And then there's a division of the rest of it amongst sort of longer fixes and some trackers. And what I get a lot of comments from people is that they read one of our stories and there was an expert in there talking about why five-year fixed rate mortgages were a good idea. And they thought they agreed with that sentiment. And then they called up a mortgage broker and the mortgage broker said to them, no, take a two-year fix and try to talk them round. And they say, why am I reading one thing here? And then when I phone this person, he's telling me to take a two-year fix. And I think it's not necessarily bad advice, but you have to question, why are you being told to take a two-year fix? Is it because that mortgage broker just wants your business again and to earn some more commission in 2 years' time? Also, if you look at the fact that, yes, two-year fixes are cheaper and you're saving on your monthly payments, but you're going to have to get another mortgage in 2 years' time, pay an extra set of fees, and then another mortgage 2 years after that and pay an extra set of fees before a five-year fix runs out. So you need to think about all of those things when you're comparing the costs. And then also the fact that most people, they find the whole mortgage process painful, boring, time-consuming, and the kind of thing that they just don't want to do. Basically, it's like me going shopping. Right? I find interest rates and inflation really interesting. I hate shops. But, you know, for many other people, it's the other way around. And so actually, when it comes time to remortgage in 2 years' time, there's nothing they'd like to do less. And so quite a lot of them don't bother doing it, or they have all that hassle. And it's like, wouldn't you rather just not have to worry about this for 5 years and have some financial security? And people ask themselves the wrong questions. They basically ask themselves the question of, how much will I save each month? Will interest rates still be low in 2 years? Well, how much do I save each month? As I said, you have to compare that to all those extra fees and the hassle and everything else. And then, will interest rates still be low in 2 years? You can't get any more than a best guess answer to that. And you have to take into account the fact that the base rate might still be low in 2 years, but we might have a banking crisis and banks might not want to lend. We might have an economy in recession and banks might not want to lend. Loans could be tougher to get. Mortgage rates could rise without that happening. And the big problem in 2007 was that basically people were coming off the end of two-year fixed rates and then they couldn't get another mortgage. And so then they were finding themselves pushed onto the standard variable rate, which is much more expensive. And trust me, 3 or 4 months on that standard variable rate will eat up any saving that you made by taking a two-year fix over a five-year fix. So I think, and I'm well over my 2 minutes, that the kind of big questions people should be asking themselves are lifestyle questions. Mm-hmm. It's, how long will I live here before I move? Now, most people underestimate this, and we're spending much longer in properties than we used to. But if you're a first-time buyer, you know, moving into a small place, you might spend less time there than someone buying a family home. Will we have children that would mean we need more space? If you've just got married, you'd quite like kids, you're in your mid-30s and you're moving into a one-bedroom flat, chances are you're probably going to be moving quite soon. If that's not the case, then maybe you won't outgrow that property for quite some time. Am I thinking about going self-employed? Lots of people do this. Going self-employed basically kills your chances of borrowing money on a mortgage for quite a number of years. So if you're thinking about going self-employed next year, don't take a two-year fix, because you're going to struggle to remortgage a year after that. Take a five-year fix. And then the other thing I said of, do I really want to bother going through this whole rigmarole again in 2 short years? So think about things like that. And I think we should give things like that equally as much weight as we do to saving £30 or £40 a month.
Thank you very much, Simon. And a problem with the banks? No. Where would you get an idea like that from?
Consuming issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce of This Is Money here with me, Georgie Frost. And BHS is back. Sort of. The stricken retailer, which collapsed into the hands of administrators in April, is being revived online via its new owner, the Qatar-based Almana Group. BHS.com will sell a range of lighting, bedroom and bathroom products, with kitchen, dining and clothing ranges going on sale next month. But the cyber revival, with its 84 employees, will give little comfort, I imagine, to the 11,000 former BHS staff who lost their jobs this summer, nor the thousands affected by the chain's £571 million pension black hole. So how did this all come about in the first place, is retail analyst Richard Hyman.
This is effectively starting again. So they have bought the international assets and the website and its customer base from the administrator. And I think that is great news in the sense that a very large number of people lost their jobs and have been treated pretty shabbily. And these people have come along, and it's a vote of confidence in the brand and in the people that ran those two bits of old BHS, i.e. the international and the online bit, who they've re-employed, which I think is one small bit of positive news against the background of loads of very negative news about that company and its previous owners.
And there is loads of negative news. But Lee, tell us more about what's happening.
So it launched BHS.com yesterday. It's looking to sell up to 75% of the most popular things it was selling before it went into administration. Now, the things that BHS did do pretty well, lighting, for example, I think a lot of people do think of BHS and do think of lighting. So they've got all that sort of stuff coming in. Now, 80 people are going to be running this website, which is a little blip from the 11,000 that have lost their jobs. And obviously trying to play onto the loyalty factor. Are people really going to stay loyal to BHS? Were people loyal to BHS? Was that not the problem in the first place?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so I don't know if it's just going to be a
good question. Was that a problem in the first place? Was it badly run? What was the fundamental problem? And can they fix it online?
I think that it is very similar to Woolworths. Let's put it this way, right? So Woolworths also tried to resurrect online. I don't know if it's still going online now, actually, but I know that I remember they tried to resurrect it online. But the problem then, of course, was the loyalty had gone. Mm. I didn't know what I'd go into Woolworths for, you know, and I didn't know what I'd go into BHS for. Only lighting. That was probably the only thing I could ever associate with it. And that is what it's trying to resurrect. So perhaps it will be a success. And I don't want to start going, this is not going to be a success when it's only just launched. We'll just have to wait and see. But interestingly, we were looking yesterday and there was much confusion in This Is Money Towers when we discovered that there's actually another website called BHS Direct, which is completely separate and is selling mainly electricals. And we can't figure out how that's come about. So it appears that there's two different BHSs. You've got the official BHS.com that's been bought out, the name's been bought, and then you've got BHS Direct that appears to be someone else that's trading off the back of the name. So
it's worth an investigation.
It is. Beware. I would just stick to BHS.com until we've really got to the bottom of what BHSdirect.com is.
Yeah, do indeed. But one final question on this one. Can they pull it back in terms of bad PR? But also, I mean, I think you mentioned on a previous show, Lee, that when you went into the store in the latter days, it was not great.
Well,
those memories are going to stick in people's minds when you go online, when a lot of the stuff was dirty, it was all sprawled out, broken.
Perhaps, but then I think the staff were broken. You know, they'd had enough. They're talking about not having their pensions and they're not, you know, not exactly on massive wages, and they've probably just fed up with it all. So I wouldn't let that taint, you know, my future, you know, buying habits, just for the fact that it was a bit of a difficult situation, or a very difficult situation. I think if they're going to make this website a success, they're going to have to really focus on good products, you know, good delivery times, no messing around, and just good customer service. I mean, there's 80 staff. If that does start getting busy, you know, it could start coming under the cosh. Perhaps people are just going to buy stuff and send it back.
Maybe. Yes, exactly. Maybe. Sticking with retail, the battle of the supermarkets continues, doesn't it? It was a bad news week from Sainsbury's announcing its second consecutive quarter fall in sales. Those pesky German discounters, something at least for the Germans to cheer at the moment, though. Aldi is to open 70 new stores in Britain as part of a 300 million revamp following a record-breaking year for sales. It can thank its premium wine for much of that. They sell 9 bottles a second. But now it's got middle-class favourite Waitrose well and truly in its sight. But not everyone sees this as good news for the retailer. Here's Rodney Hobson from Morningstar.
It's a German company. It's privately owned, so you can't buy shares in it here. It's really got its nuisance value because it's upsetting the shares of supermarkets you can buy. But all the figures in this statement are good and they're all strong and they're all optimistic except one. And that's the one that counts, and that's the profits. So they're increasing sales. Sales were up 12% in the year. Sales are higher, but the operating profits are down 1.8% because they're the ones who are cutting prices. Now, it's all very well annoying Tesco and Sainsbury's and Morrison's, but it's going to hurt Aldi as well. And Aldi uses this dreadful phrase, continued investment in prices. I do hate it. What they mean is they have reduced prices. You don't invest in prices. Oh, nonsense. They all talk this nonsense.
There you go. Rodney Hobson there pulling no punches. Interesting times for Aldi. What do you make of it, Simon?
I think that I 100% agree with what was just said. One of the things that always drives me crazy is when supermarkets say they're investing in bringing down prices. That's such a moronic statement. You don't invest in bringing down prices. You just sell things for less and make less profit. We're investing in bringing down prices. It's like they've actively taken the decision to make less money. We're investing in making less money. I think that Aldi is a great success story. Mm-hmm. I think the Lidl is a great success story. I question how long the rampant rise of the two discounters can continue. You don't see a scenario really where businesses keep growing at such a rate for so long, but I think there's probably quite a bit more room for them to keep going. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting thing now is how much do they keep the sort of back to basics atmosphere, the, you know, selling less stuff, no fancy displays, you just walk around the shop, pick some stuff up and leave. And how much do they start pushing down the prettying things up?
Well, that's it, clearly they're not. 300 million revamp, 70 new stores, premium wines, they've got Waitrose in their sight, they're going bigger, they're going better. How can they keep true to that budget model?
Well, the one thing I would say is the £300 million revamp, you have to remember that £300 million, whilst a sum of money that probably none of us will ever have or could never dream of having, just doesn't seem to go that far in the modern world. Am I the only person astonished by how much stuff costs? You know, it's like, how on earth did we spend so much money on hosting the Olympics, for example? How does that cost so much money? But yeah, £300 million probably doesn't go that far. It probably doesn't do that much in terms of prettying up all of those shops. But I think, Lee, I know you're a big fan of walking around a back-to-basics supermarket. If they prettied it up, if they made it less back-to-basics, would you be more likely to go in there or less?
I think some of the stores are starting to look a little bit tired, actually, between Aldi and Lidl. I mean, they've been around for quite a long time now, obviously blown up in the last couple of years. I know £300 million, as Simon says, it doesn't actually sound that massive in the retail world, but the one thing I will say is that their supermarkets, in some instances, are about a quarter of the size of a Tesco store, maybe even a little bit smaller than that. Yeah. So that paint probably stretches a little bit further than it would in a Tesco store, which you can get lost in for about half a day. I think that Aldi's going to continue to do pretty well. I mean, I'm going through some of my middle-class friends that do go quite frequently. I'm thinking about my girlfriend's parents, who I was really shocked recently told me that they pop into Aldi and Lidl for the wine. They really like the way it's laid out. It is really well laid out, and they have all the tasting notes on there. They give it a rating out of 100, and they found some really good bottles of wine for £5 that they were getting elsewhere, 15, 20 quid. So they're happy to go in there. And they always put the wine right at the back corner, as they do in all supermarkets. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of wind your way through. And you will end up with at least a basket full of goods where you go, well, that's a bit random and German. I'll pick that up and see what it's like.
Well, that's one money-saving tip, isn't it? But it's time to get out the balloons, crack open the champagne and party like it's 1966. Not because we're nearly at the end of the show and not because that was a time when England football was great. Shakes head. it was when Money Mail first launched 50 years ago to help families make their cash work harder. So to celebrate, you've compiled a list of your favourite tips and tricks to help you save, from parking your car on a stranger's driveway to never going into a pound shop. There's something for everyone. Do go online for that. But I want to know some of your fave just very quickly, Simon, from you.
My favourite was the sheer volume of comments from people who said, if a stranger parks on my driveway, I'll have something to say about it.
I did wonder about that.
Yeah. So I liked the... what was my favourite here? Calm down. There you go.
Right.
Aggressive drivers use up to a third more fuel than gentle ones. Boring? Well, assume you drive 10,000 miles a year. If you pay around £1.10 per litre for petrol and get 40 miles to the gallon, this would cost £1,250. Aggressive drivers doing 30 miles per gallon would pay an extra £416. That should put a smile on your face next time a boy racer cuts you up at the traffic lights. And buy lost goods. Police auctions, the Bumblebee auctions online. Although I think there's a lot of people who've cottoned onto that, who basically buy them and then sell them on for more money.
So money saving and a health tip. Lee, quick one from you.
I really like the fact that Amazon's not always the cheapest, and that's something I've really sort of embraced this year, and I've started using the library a lot more. I was finding myself a commute, so I read 2 books a week. That's probably a 10-15 quid a week habit, 60 quid a month. Instead, I've just been going to the local library, getting out books. No more Amazon, no more Waterstones. It's great.
Lee, with your dodgy living, your habit a week of book reading. Consumer Affairs editor Lee Boyce, editor Simon Lambert. Hello, I'm Georgie Frost. Join me and the team from This Is Money live each week for the This Is Money show, brought to you by NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years. This is what happened last time on This Is Money.
Don't like shops. I don't go into them, so I spend less money. It's that simple. Also, I'm not really into that whole thing that appears to be my wife's hobby, which is buying clothes on the internet so she can send them back.
This Is Money, brought to you by NS&I, each Friday at 11 o'clock or on demand via the website or Share Radio app.